Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, June 6. COVID cases are spiking. Queens Hospital is telling its workers that Hawaii's COVID viral load in wastewater is among the highest in the country. Healthcare workers are among those getting sick. And FESPAC 2024 officially opens tonight with the Parade of Nations. D-Day commemorations got underway in Normandy, France. We remember Hawaii soldiers who took part in the bloody battle 8 decades ago. We also hear how that historic event led to a career studying war history. And by and about, Kumukuhua brings a trilogy of plays written by a native Hawaiian playwright to the stage, It's a Hanaho. The conversation starts right after the latest headlines. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. COVID continues, cases continue on an uptick, according to the latest COVID dashboard. This morning, we talked to the head of the Healthcare Association of Hawaii, Hilton Rathel. The health department's COVID dashboard numbers are still spiking. Positivity rates have doubled in the last month and are in the double-digit range. Here's Rathel.
That's a matter of concern because it means there's more people out there who are positive. Because roughly the same number of tests are being done. It's just that more of them now are coming back as positive. We've also seen a material increase in hospitalizations of people who are COVID positive. Now, that doesn't mean that everyone who is positive for COVID in a hospital is being treated for COVID, but inpatients are still being tested. And we have had over 100 COVID patients a day for a number of days now. And again, that is much higher than we've had for a long time. The last time we had 100 COVID-positive patients in our hospitals was August of last year. And we have been as low as having less than 20 COVID-positive patients in our hospitals in the last few months. So there is certainly an increased number of COVID patients in our hospitals. The good news is the number of patients who are COVID-positive in the ICU is still very low. So that means that the severity of illness from COVID is low, but there's certainly a much higher prevalence, or there's a lot more people with COVID in our community. So there's a small number of COVID patients in the ICU, but the total number of COVID patients in our hospitals has materially increased over the last month.
And what can you tell us about the snapshot with the healthcare workers?
Yes, because there's a higher incidence of COVID in the community, that's going to have an impact on our healthcare workers as well. So as I just mentioned, our positivity rate is twice what it was a month ago to the general population. And some of those individuals are going to be our healthcare workers. And because healthcare workers need to be very cautious if they are positive, then that is definitely having an impact on our workforce because more of our healthcare workers are testing positive for COVID. Now, there is another piece of good news, which is that our hospital census has been high for a long time because of COVID. But since the beginning of this year, actually over the last 3 months, our total hospitalizations or the total census in our hospitals has come down. And so our hospitals is not as full as they were a few months ago. And that means that that takes the pressure off the staffing. So the fact that we do have some of our staff or an increased number of our staff who are going out sick, that's offset by the fact that our total hospital census or the total patients we have in our hospitals has come down a little bit. So that is balancing that out.
I understand that in some units, though, they are limiting visitors and just making sure that the caregivers are masked up, just taking those extra precautions just to prevent against the spread.
Yeah, well, that is very true because the strains that are out there right now they get transmitted very, very easily, and we are very concerned because there is a higher incidence of COVID in the community, materially higher incidence of COVID in the community than what there was a couple of months ago. That means we do need to take extra precautions. That's good public health measures. And so there are some restrictions on the number of visitors that can get into a hospital. And there's certainly an encouragement to, if you are in a hospital, if you're interacting with patients, to have increased masking.
And, you know, I did see a memo that underscored that Hawaii has one of the highest levels of COVID-19 wastewater viral activity in the country. Do we have a sense as to, you know, what that means?
That's consistent with the fact that we're seeing a much higher positivity rate. So that means that there are more people who have COVID or a COVID positive, or a lot of people may not even know. Some people may not know that they are positive for COVID if they don't have strong symptoms, or they may have some mild symptoms and just think it's a cold or flu or something like that. So, but it definitely reinforces the fact that there is a materially higher incidence of COVID in the community than there was a couple of months ago. Whether that's going to increase or whether it's going to plateau, we don't know yet. But again, we have twice as many people testing positive now than what we did a month ago or 2 months ago.
But I know that many people are not testing for COVID. Either they're out of tests and they don't want to purchase them, or maybe their tests are expired and so they just aren't checking.
Well, that is very true, because the federal government ran out of funds to keep supplying tests and sending tests out. And because the acuity of how virulent the strains are, while they are very easily transmissible, they're not resulting in the same levels of illness and death that some of the earlier strains were, like Delta or Omicron, for example. So the federal government has run out of money, or has stopped allocating money for testing. And as you said, many people may have tests that have expired, they don't want to use them, or their symptoms may be relatively mild. And so they're just saying, look, I'll just keep doing what I'm doing. But if they're going to school, if they're going to work, if they're going to a shopping mall, if they're going to a restaurant, then they may be positive and they may be spreading COVID. And that may be one of the reasons that the spread is happening, is because people are much more active. Even if they think they're positive, they may not be wearing a mask, for example. So it becomes a self-perpetuating. If the more people you have a positive, the more likely there is for them to infect other people.
So I think this is probably a good time just to remind the general public about just some of the basics, you know, for washing hands and masking and doing all the things that we did during the height of the pandemic, particularly since, you know, we've got a number of cultural festivities that are taking place here on Oahu that could be super spreader events if they're indoors. But you just want people to be careful and be safe.
We absolutely do. And we would continue to encourage people to get vaccinated. There are vaccines that are very safe, they're very effective, they're readily available. You can get them at Long's, you can get them at Walgreens, you can get them at your doctor's office, get them at a FQHC, a community health center. So there's lots of places you can get the vaccine. But if you do, if anyone has symptoms that they think could be COVID, if they don't have a test, they should just take the precautions. And wearing a mask while you still have symptoms, especially if you're out, is a very, very good thing to do. We are concerned about large numbers of people being in close quarters at some of these events. And the fact that FestPac has coincided with this increase in Hawaii is not necessarily positive.
That was Hilton Rathel, head of the Hawaii Healthcare Association, talking with us this morning. The Department of Health has updated its COVID dashboard, and cases are still spiking. Officials issued an advisory about the uptick last week and urged the public to stay safe, use some of the best practices from the height of the pandemic. Good hygiene, vaccines, and masking all can help to avoid the spread of COVID and other respiratory infections.
Support support for HPR comes from Malamaola Health Services on Oahu, founded by physicians, dedicated to providing hospice and palliative care to patients and their families. Learn more about services at malamaolacares.com.
In China, Big Brother is most definitely watching, and might even be watching from right next door.
When the police goes out and tries to recruit informants, they have a lot of leverage. They can make life pretty miserable. You will be doing yourself a favor working for the police.
The lives of 16 million Chinese citizens pulled into the government's citizen spy network. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
The official opening ceremonies for FESPAC takes place this evening at the University of Hawaii Manoa campus. HPR's Kuvei Hirishi plans to be there. She was on hand yesterday for the arrival of canoes at Kualoa Regional Park. She joins us now to talk about the va'a ceremony. Good morning.
Good morning. Right? Anyone with a view of Kualoa Bay on Oahu's windward side Wednesday morning could see this parade of va'a sailing in to Hakipu'u. 26 canoes, all different sort of shapes and sizes, carrying leaders from the 22 Pacific Island nations that are all here, as you mentioned, for the Festival of the Pacific Arts and Culture, or FESPAC. Most of the canoes participating in the va'a arrival ceremony sailed in from across the Hawaiian Islands, Hokulea, Makali'i, just to name a few. But we also welcomed some voyaging canoes and sort of like smaller fishing canoes from the Cook Islands, Tahiti, Sarawa there in Yap, and Aotearoa.
I was so jealous. I really wanted to be there, but I had to work.
No, it was beautiful. And not just the va'a, but there were probably about hundreds of Pacific Islanders, lots of folks here from, the host community here in Hawaii, lining the beach there at Hakipu'u to greet their delegates in the sort of the sounds of their homelands. They were conch shells and Tahitian drums, the Maori sort of a wooden trumpet, pukaia, and the didgeridoo. There were so many sounds and dances and traditional fashion as well to sort of mark the ceremonial celebration, or ceremonial opening, if you will, of FESPAC. Tapu Tapu Atea Mayor Toma Matom arrived at Hakipu'u. He told me through an interview, through an interpreter, that FESPAC is an opportunity to let the next generation of Pacific Islanders know where they're from and to remind them to be proud of their heritage.
Ce rassemblement permettra de faire rappeler notre future génération parce que nous les avons.
Mayor Matom says, this gathering allows us to remind our future generations of the importance of their homeland and their heritage, because aspects of that culture and heritage have been disappearing over time. But on the other hand, he says it's the future generations that remind us of what our kupuna have done and been able to do in preserving those cultural practices and that heritage that lives on and is going to be showcased over the next 10 days at FESPAC. And FESPAC, of course, began in 1972 to promote cultural exchange among Pacific Islanders who feared Western influence would lead to sort of a loss of culture and traditions. One of the most visible impacts, at least yesterday, of this idea of cultural exchange is the revival of deep sea voyaging amongst our Pacific Island nations. Papamoapialuag, a famous name among voyagers across the Pacific, especially with the Polynesian Voyaging Society here in Hawaii. He was instrumental in helping Native Hawaiians revive the practice of deep sea voyaging and navigating va'a by using, nature as his guide. Papamau's son, Master Navigator Sisaro Sawaru, traveled to Hawaii from Sarawa Yap, and he had his two sort of a smaller fishing size va'a, but these beautiful lauhala woven sails. Mm. He says his dad's work really helped perpetuate their traditions in Sarawa and beyond.
I will say that it is very important because we are struggling to practice our culture. And I've been sailing around the Pacific with the Hokulea and the other canoes. I've seen a lot of people come here to share our cultures and to continue on, perpetuate what belongs to us. There's a lot of kids still practicing now as they understand that as a small island nation, that navigation is the most important thing, that, we're very limited on resources. Then we need to sail to different places to bring food for the whole community.
cultural exchange among Pacific Islanders over the last 50 years since this festival began, you know, really helped to revive not only navigation traditions, but cultural traditions here in Hawaii, from tattooing to weaving to carving. In fact, many of the canoes at the arrival ceremony would not be here if not for that exchange between Papamoa and the Native Hawaiians back in the 70s. But there was a strong sense of Pacific Island solidarity at yesterday's event. You could kind of hear it in the background noise of some of these interviews. And I anticipate that energy will carry on through the next week and a half. The theme of this year's festival is Ho'olulahui, which means regenerating Oceania. Over the course of the next 10 days, Pacific Islanders will explore the challenges and successes of perpetuating these longstanding, you know, cultural traditions and artistic practices. But they'll also discuss some of the most pressing issues for Pacific Island nations moving forward. Here's Master Pole Navigator Nainoa Thompson delivering his remarks yesterday during the Va'a arrival ceremony.
We need to take care of this earth. Otherwise, the earth will always find a way to restore itself. The question is, can humanity do that? I'm not trying to scare anybody, but wildfires, hurricanes, sea level rising. Who knows it better than those in the Pacific who had nothing to do with climate change, but are suffering the first and the most? My concern is governments around the world have not shown that they're going to take action for what needs to happen. I think FESPAC is the way to do this because it brings in people that are from the communities. FESPAC is too far apart every 4 years. We need to have some annual, some way to connect, stay connected so that this doesn't become an event, but it becomes a beginning.
There was some applause at the end of that remark because FESPAC is every 4 years. Mm-hmm. And most recently, because of COVID, there was a delay there. A push to 2024. And so there was this sort of anticipation, I believe, in the community during those remarks that, yeah, we should be getting together a little more frequently, especially when it comes to these issues like climate change.
Oh, yes, because we have, you know, so much in common, you know, some of the same problems, and we all can learn from each other. And, you know, that's the whole thing, is to engage. So engage more often than 4 years. And it doesn't have to be such a big spectacle, because it is a monumental effort to mount these.
It is, and big hands up applause to those that have been organizing the various events. So many, not just within FESPAC itself, but organizations and businesses that have decided to kind of jump in and take advantage of having, I believe, 2,000-something delegates from across the Pacific here in Hawaii for the next 10 days. And so, as you mentioned, the official opening ceremonies tonight this afternoon, 4 p.m. at the Sun Sheriff's Center. And there will also be a Va'a festival at Kualoa Bay this Saturday for anyone who's interested in learning more about the various Va'a traditions from our Pacific Islands.
Yeah, and I understand from one of the organizers that there'll be additional information about a lot of those breakout segments at the convention center. You know, they're being finalized as we speak. And so hopefully all that will be on the website, so people will kind of get a feel, you know, if they want to focus on something in particular,
right,
that they'll have a better sense of what's going on.
So much going on. But yes, as you mentioned, they're constantly updating things. So stay abreast on that website to get more information.
Yeah, but again, big spectacle, lots of opportunities to engage with our brothers and sisters across the Pacific. And yeah, it's going to be pretty exciting, you know. But again, as we heard in the previous segment, be careful, you know.
Yes, mask up.
Yes, mask up. Just you know, take those precautions, because we don't want people to get sick. We want people to enjoy their time here and just stay safe, right?
Yes, agreed.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Kuvehi, and hope to see you out there in the next 10 days.
Yes, mahalo.
All right. We've been talking with HPR's Kuvehi Rishi about the Va'a ceremony that happened at Kualoa yesterday that welcomed delegates to the 13th Festival of the Pacific Arts and Culture, FESPAC 2024. Find this story and follow our FESPAC coverage at hawaiipublicradio.org. Thank you.
How many people in this economy are working, aren't working, or aren't working but want to, isn't always easy to discover.
You want to know how many people are looking for work, who's not looking for work and why, and who is and why, then you need a household survey.
I'm Kai Rizdal, the jobs report and whence we get the data for it. Next time on Marketplace.
Beginning this evening at 6, following All Things Considered.
When Ted Slingerland was learning how to salsa dance, his instructor kept telling him to relax. There was just one problem.
The more she told me to relax, the tenser I got. It just was this terrible, vicious circle.
Learning how to let go, this week, on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Beginning this evening at 7.
80 years ago, Allied nations stormed the beaches of Normandy to push out the Germans who had invaded France. President Joe Biden and President Macron took part in the commemoration ceremonies that included some of the last of the veterans who took part in that effort to end World War II. Among those in attendance for the historic event, Ahoy Congresswoman Jill Takuda and former Congressman Charles DeJoux, who we talked to on our show last week. The casualty count of the Battle of Normandy was stunning. Germany lost 320,000, America 135,000, Great Britain 65,000, and Canada 18,000. Buried at the American Cemetery are five soldiers from Hawaii: First Sergeant William Anderson, Technical Sergeant Clarence Campbell, Staff Sergeant John Kupa, Private Henry Saaga, and First Lieutenant Herbert Truslow. Another Hawaii airman who we remember today parachuted into the battlefield at Normandy. William Bill Patey was featured on a PBS Hawaii's Long Story Short segment with Leslie Wilcox back in 2016. Patey recalled his harrowing experiences as a prisoner of war.
We dropped 6 miles further inland than we were supposed to, and then on top of that, we dropped right on top of a German parachute regiment that had been training right in that area. Yeah, it wasn't a comfortable landing, you know.
What happened when you landed?
Well, I ran into a French milkmaid early on. Milk, and some of you have heard that story, that she was D-Day morning, all this firing's going on. We've had skirmishes all night long from midnight. And you could hear the big shells from the Navy cruisers outside, offshore coming in. The Spitfires and all were all over the place. She's milking a cow in the middle of the hedgerow. And I walk over, I tell my sergeant very quickly, we didn't know exactly where they were and where the Germans were, and I go to give them my best Pinot French. Il y a des beurs, je suis un American officier, il y a des éléments prédici. It's supposed to mean where are the Germans around here. She doesn't say anything, milks a cow. And, but she moves her head like this, and I look, and there's a German patrol coming down the road just above us. So I jump back over the hedgerow, but I think I told my sergeant that I think I'm going to get us a date tonight. I said, Captain, you didn't do too good, did you?
You have a date with a German regiment.
Yeah. And I became a POW. And it was a very humbling, frustrating experience for me. One of the worst things that could have happened, that I was taken out of combat by the great men I've been training with all this time, and they going on to combat without me. And I never got over that for many, many years.
What were conditions like for you as a POW?
Well, it's nothing's good about being a POW. The Germans, in terms of handling their officers, POWs were more lenient than they were with the enlisted. But by and large, if they went hungry, we went hungry. But it could have been worse. I think the worst part was being transported in 40 by boxcars, all jammed in together. And then they shipped us up across France and into Germany. And every time you had a marshaling yard, they changed engines. And then the Spitfires or the P-47s would come down, and the sirens would go off. And there you are, locked in this boxcar, you know. And that got to be a little wearing.
Did you worry that they'd kill you?
As
a POW?
No, they were...
Or torture you?
No, we didn't get any treatment like that. But if you try to get away, they they don't get very happy about that.
You tried to get away.
Yeah.
What'd you try?
Well, first of all, coming down after I was wounded, they put me in an ambulance, and the Spitfires came down and shot up the buses we were in that were wounded. And so the Germans would jump, the guys would jump out and get in the ditch, and you climbed out of the, try to get out of the bus, then you get shot. If you stayed there, you got strafed. So in the process, the bus got caught fire, and I scrambled out somehow. I was ambulatory. And got away and hung up, with a French farmer. And they took me up into the, put the way up in the little attic they had up there. But they were going to get the French resistance guys to come in and help take me up. But as it turned out, a German artillery unit came in there and set it up as a command post, and they searched the place, and there I was. So that wasn't too bad. They'd say, put me back into the bus.
They didn't discipline you?
No, not that. I was just, they were too busy doing that. It's after that, the second time was kind of a bad one.
What happened the second time you tried to get away?
The second time I got out was out of discharge from a German hospital. And you had a compound there, and they had the real barbed wire around the wall.
And what had you been treated for? I had a
Schmeisser bullet in my groin. Oh. It's still there, by the way. And they never took it out. But be that as it may, I decided that we want to try to see if we get out. Now, I guess there are several dozen, full 50 or 60, were in the compound that had been pulled together. We had an idea that four of us would get out and make a break for it. But when the time came, there were only two of us, one an Englishman and myself. So we went out with the blankets at night, and they had the watchtower, but the lights didn't go on all the time. Threw the blankets over, climbed over the barbed wire, and got down the dockway over the next one. And it gets kind of touchy there because you're not sure the light's going to come on. They're going to use the machine gun. So we got over, and it was getting close to dawn by then.
Were you cut up by the barbed wire?
We had gloves we'd gotten, and we also had blankets, so we're not too bad. So we got it, and we hightailed it off through across the field. And I guess after we'd gone a few miles, we decided we better try to hole up. And so we hole up in a cow shed. And again, a French lady came by, and we gave her our best charming French again. She said, "Man, no, wait. I was going to get help." She comes back with four Germans and two police dogs. So
far, that Puro French
didn't work out too well. But it was... that we got solitary time for that, you know.
But nothing, I mean, solitary was the worst of it?
Geneva Convention was observed quite well by them. They got bread and water and no light gives you a lesson, yeah.
That was a rebroadcast of a segment from PBS Hawaii's Long Story Short with Leslie Wilcox featuring Bill Patey. Patey returned home after the war, and he went on to become the head of Oahu Sugar Company. He later served as chairman of the Board of Land and Natural Resources. He died at the age of 97 in 2018. This morning, we talked to a war historian to give us context on this 80th anniversary of the end of World War II. Russell Hart is a professor at Hawaii Pacific University. His great uncle was also a paratrooper who fought at Normandy and ended up paralyzed. Hart tells us that today was a solemn day, remembering the many lives that were lost on that French coastline.
My great uncle was a paratrooper in the Second World War, the 1st Airborne Division, and he dropped Operation Market Garden, Arnhem, in September 1944. The Allies had broken out from Normandy and were going to try to bounce the Rhine. And unfortunately, that operation went south, and he was captured in the Osterbeck perimeter by the Waffen-SS and contracted tuberculosis in the terribly unsanitary conditions that existed in German field hospitals in the fall of 1944. and he was unfortunately permanently disabled from the tuberculosis. When we were children, family used to go and visit him on our summer holidays, and my brother and I, an identical twin, would ask him about his wartime experience and what had happened to him. And like many vets who suffered from PTSD, he really wasn't able to or willing to discuss his wartime experiences. So always a mistake to tell intelligent young boys not to tell them anything. It's better to make something up. So we would go up to the library and check out every book we could on the Normandy campaign and Northwest Europe, the war in Europe, trying to find out what had happened to him. And that's really where our interest in military history began. And we both went on to make that a professional career. My twin brother teaches at the Royal Military Academy at Sandhurst. So he teaches current British and NATO and allied officers military history, military strategy, and I came to the United States. I did my PhD at Ohio State and have been teaching here at Hawaii Pacific University for 24 years now, and I direct our program in diplomacy and military studies. So I made a professional career of studying the Second World War, my dissertation, and published it as a book, Clash of Arms, How the Allies Won in Normandy. So today is a very significant anniversary of the D-Day landing.
Well, maybe you can help give context, given the political situation of the world right now. When I was there at Normandy, I was just struck standing under the flagpoles with the flags of the Allies blowing in the wind. And that was, you know, some years ago, but that relationship had, you know, was starting to fray a bit.
Well, obviously, the absolute aims of the Axis powers in the Second World War created the world's largest historical coalition, the Allied powers, and the D-Day landings were an enormous undertaking. 160,000 troops landed, hundreds of thousands of personnel were involved in the ground, air, and maritime domains. 4,400 Allied soldiers would lose their lives on D-Day. Another 5,000 would be wounded. Total casualties for the campaign on all sides would be over 500,000. So there really was a titanic climax to the latter stage of the Second World War, which made certain the defeat of Nazi Germany. And of course, out of that wartime alliance emerged a variety of alliances, including the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, one of the world's most longstanding and important military and political alliances, linking the United States, Canada, and nations of Europe together. In defense, particularly of resurgent Russia under Vladimir Putin in the last decade. So the war in Ukraine that's going on right now is in part shaped by the course of the Second World War on the Eastern Front in the Second World War. The war in Gaza, of course, is also strongly shaped by history, by a conflicting and ambivalent promises made during the Great War and those perpetuated by the military campaigns in the Middle East in the Second World War, and of course the partition of the Korean Peninsula, the division standoff between North Korea and South Korea and its other Pacific allies. These are all long-term consequences of the course and character and outcome of the Second World War. So this is a conflict that continues to significantly shape the world that we live in today and underscores the importance of having friends and sustaining international alliances and upholding international treaties in an unstable and volatile international arena.
And right now there are some tensions with the U.S. and Israel, but back in the day things were good and then not so good between U.S. and France.
Well, certainly the relationships, all coalitions have their ups and downs, and for allies in the Second World War, obviously, have important tensions. Relationships between the U.S. and France in particular were shaped by the fact that France had been defeated in 1940. Britain continued to struggle alone until the Soviet Union joined in June 1941, and then the United States in December 1941. Those relationships were complicated by the fact that France was occupied and a Vichy regime was essentially a satellite collaborationist regime that made wartime relationships between the Allies and the Free French movement in particular full of some significant tension. But relationships are important to sustain through tough times. Again, it's important for people to remember France was, in fact, the first international ally that the United States had in the Revolutionary War, joining in support of the U.S. path to freedom, but mainly to get back and try and recover lost territory, lost to Great Britain. And, of course, the United States betrayed its first ally in the Peace of Paris in 1783, making a separate peace that basically sold out and tore up its wartime alliance with France. So our relationships go through ups and downs, but the critical thing to emphasize is the importance of sustaining long-term positive relationships with allies. We live in a world of many threats where the United States can't afford to act unilaterally and requires support, assistance from like-minded nations around the world. And those relationships are very important and need to be tended to and sustained over time.
And then anything else you want to say just as you think about your great uncle and this big anniversary?
Sure. Well, I think this is a bittersweet celebration because I think this is probably may well be the last anniversary where veterans of the campaign will attend. We do these major celebrations every 5 years. All the attendees this year, there's about 24 US attendees and about 30 British attendees and a few Canadian. Obviously, they're all in their late 90s or even we have some over 100. And it's probably unlikely that any of them, or maybe just a very few of them, are going to be alive in 5 years for the 85th anniversary. So this is a very poignant and very special anniversary because it's probably the last one where a significant number of veterans of the D-Day landings and the Normandy campaign will be able to participate. So we'll see a passing of generation and with that, how society will view the legacy of the Normandy campaign and the campaign itself may well shift in the next couple of decades as that wartime generation passes. Certainly true of the Great War, right? Mm-hmm. That conflict was so traumatic to Western civilization that it really took the passing of that World War One, the Great War generation, for scholars and historians to really be able to fully comprehend its true nature. So perhaps we'll see something similar.
Were you able to watch any of the coverage at all?
I watched a little bit, having been to Normandy and bought those speeches. It was a poignant moment of pride and sadness.
That was HPU Professor Russell Hart, whose great uncle was a paratrooper in the war. He wrote a book about the war entitled Clash of Arms, How the Allies Won in Normandy. Thanks to PBS Hawaii for that clip with Bill Patey. We will share links to the original interview at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, Ohana, working to protect and manage Oahu's water resources since 1929, for fresh water now and for future generations. BoardofWaterSupply.com. This summer, enjoy live jazz music at HPR's Atherton Studio. Our Hawaii Jazz Performance Series presents Hot Club of Hulaville, featuring Kelsey Armstrong, the Tommy James Trio, Arara Givento, and Eha Batutas. HPR will record these performances for future broadcasts and online viewing. Learn more at hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Farm Lovers Markets. Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art, serving art experiences, live music, and dinner and beverages until 9 p.m. on Fridays at Homa Nights. HonoluluMuseum.org.
Come Out trilogy is widely recognized as one of the first theater productions written by Native Hawaiian. It features Native characters and focuses on cultural and historical issues. It started with Come Out that debuted in 1994. It was followed by Come Out A'e in 1998 and then Ua'apau in 2019. The trilogy was written by Eva Beach native Alani Apio. He grew up as a voracious reader when his exercise-induced asthma restricted his physical activity. He started as an English major at the University of Hawaii, and along the way, he fell in love with theater and added it as a second major. For the first time, Kumukahua Theater is staging the entire Come Out trilogy. The Conversation's Russell Subiono got the chance to talk to Apio about the landmark series.
Some of the themes that kind of pop out are kuleana to the land, kuleana to family, which at times are in conflict with each other. Also the impact of capitalism and colonialism on Hawaiian culture. What themes did you intend to explore when you wrote the trilogy? And were there any kind of themes that just kind of popped up as you were writing along the way?
Well, the other huge impact on my life was I took a Hawaiian history class somewhere in there in my years from the late Haunani Cape Trask, Professor Trask. And for the first time in my life, I was exposed to not only a deeper understanding, a truer understanding of what actually happened here, but she was able to lay out history and weave it into what colonialism and imperialism and capitalism does to Native societies, not just ours, across the Pacific, right, in the Caribbean, you know, wherever colonial powers interacted with Native peoples. And it started to click with me very deeply, an understanding of what had actually happened to us and why there was so much pain that we experienced as Hawaiians. And, you know, back then, this is mid-80s, nobody talked about trauma. It wasn't a word that we were familiar with. But by then, I had experienced multiple suicides in my family, in my friend circle, family going off to prison, friends going off to prison, lives being torn apart and being crushed, primarily Hawaiian men. And I too felt this, like, this deep hurt and pain. And, you know, it is just a fact. I'm not, you know, I contemplated suicide. I thought about it a lot. And I had cousins who went that way. And I had friends who went that way. And it tore me apart deeply. But her class and then subsequent learning made me realize that much of our self-hatred, which in its, you know, most devastating form turned inward and made us kill ourselves, was because of all the history that had happened to us and the fact that at very basic levels, the kane, the Hawaiian male, had been emasculated over the last century and a half in the overtaking of our culture and our sovereignty and our islands in such a way that we functionally didn't have a place anymore in the ways that we were taught. I was taught to feed my family from the land. And I couldn't do that coming out of college. There was nowhere that I could make a living doing that. I was very deliberate when I wrote Ka Mau to explore all of these issues and unmask them, because nobody was talking about it. Nobody talked to me about it. You know, nobody in my family or my friend circles was saying, hey, Alani, maybe you're hurting and angry and sad and devastated because you don't have a place in your traditional role as a kanaka in this modern capitalist, transactionally oriented society.
Did writing Come Out or the subsequent plays, did that help you process some of the intergenerational trauma that you've shared?
So I started writing Ka Mau in my mid-20s, in the mid-80s. And that was approximately 30 to 35 years ago. And in the ensuing years, I have lost more cousins and more friends and more schoolmates to suicide and drug addiction and prison. And there was a sense of catharsis when I wrote each of these plays. But I have to tell you that in the past couple of months, I've found myself back in pretty severe depression, because while I can see clearer now why things have happened the way they have, I never get over the loss of my loved ones. And reliving these stories has been like it's ripping open old wounds that had healed over and scarred. And that's okay, you know, and it means that I'm still a feeling human being. I can understand better and I can choose differently on my own path, but I don't think I'm ever going to get over the loss of my loved ones.
When I look back at when you said you first started writing Kamau in the mid-80s, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't produced until 94. Did it just take you that long to write it?
Yeah. So I would start and write a scene, and it was so painful that I would put it in a drawer and try to forget about it. And it took probably about 4 or 5 years to work through all that pain. There was no counseling back then. I didn't go to a psychologist, you know, or have any way to like process it in a healthy way. And then I'm in my mid-20s, in the mid-80s, which was a brutal environment here. Yeah. We were in a recession. And, you know, when things come to you firsthand, in other words, I graduate college with a degree in drama and theater in Hawaii. And I knew there was no way that I was going to make a living from that job. And I made the conscious decision to stay here in Hawaii because I love the islands, I love my family, and I wasn't going to leave for LA or New York or Chicago or Seattle, where I actually could potentially make it as an artist, as a writer or an actor. And what I had to do was scramble just to make ends meet. At one point, I was on food stamps and kind of couch surfing. So I wasn't able to focus my time. And nobody knew who I was and nobody knew that I was a playwright. So there were no offers for money. And even now, it was like, I've made a pittance over the last 30 years as a playwright. So it took me a while, both because of the emotional and practical realities. You know, theater actually was much more vibrant in Hawaii back then, in part because we didn't, in my opinion, we didn't have the internet. It was still difficult to bring in audiences because the beach, you know, and the outdoors and the beautiful mountains, our ability to get outside and enjoy the world for free, enjoy a beautiful world for free, right? So community theater here has always struggled, but Kumu was doing, and all the theaters, I think functionally, they were doing a lot better then. So they had to build me into their season. And so it ended up that I was several seasons out. Plus, I was an unknown and untested voice. So that's a long story of why it took so long to get to the stage.
The trilogy will be performed over the next 5 weeks at Kumukahua Theater. And this is the first time that all three plays are being performed. In fact, you can see them performed consecutively on
Sundays.
What do you hope audiences will take away from the plays, especially since they can essentially like binge watch the plays just like we do with so many of the streaming services.
So now having seen them all together, because there's been at least one set of nights where I've seen one after another, two things. One is, if you can handle the emotional intensity, I would recommend people come on Sundays and watch all three together, because there's an added intensity, an added depth, and an immediate resolution without giving away the ending of the third play that is different from watching it over three nights or 3 weeks of nights. So that's one thing. I'm really saddened by the fact that these plays are still absolutely relevant in what has happened to us as Kanaka. Back in 2000, I wrote this searing editorial about the loss of our lands and our culture called A Thousand Tiny Cuts to Genocide. And in it, I proposed that over my lifetime, I would see the loss of our culture because we didn't have sovereignty and thus we didn't have control over land and language where we could practice and be. I had the wrong reason. I thought it was because we didn't have land and language. And in one sense, it is true. But what I didn't realize that had been happening all along is that the economy of the United States, the capitalist economy that we live under and have lived under since the late 1800s, has been forcing not only Kanaka Oʻiwi, but local people to leave these islands since the mid-1900s. And as we most all know now, there are more Kanaka living outside of Hawaii than are living in it. And so what I see is we're going to lose our islands and we're being bought out by the wealthy and rich from all over the world that can afford it. And it's all legal under United States law. So by the end of the trilogy, you realize all that is playing out in the trilogy over three generations. And what I hope for people to do is take a look around and say, is today any different? And if I'm fine with it, great, go on with your life. But if I'm not, what am I going to do about it?
What an interesting paradox to have written a piece of art that endures, but at the same time.
Yeah, I wish I could write a different story that's happening.
Right.
It ain't the truth.
Alania Pio, thanks so much for coming into the station today.
Mahalo nui. I appreciate it. Aloha.
That was Oahu-born playwright Alania Pio talking to HBR's Russell Subiono about his Kamau trilogy. You can catch performances of all three plays at Kumukuhua Theater through the end of the month in two ways. You can watch one play a night, Thursday through Saturday, or all three consecutively on Sunday. We'll have a link to more information on the conversation page of our website after the show. And a reminder, if you know someone who is in crisis, contact the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline at 988. Ai ala ie I kawai e o I kau ka valera toli uri. That is it for us today. Up tomorrow, we have a Hanaho show for you around summer reads. They feature some of Honolulu Magazine's award winners. Give us some feedback. Call our Talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Want to listen back to something? Find the Conversation podcast on Spotify, Apple, or Google, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.